Hosea, the first book of the minor prophets, not called the minor prophets except by some church designation somewhere along the line. Originally, the Hebrews just called them the 12, the 12 books and the 12 words of God. Now, in this, of course, you know what I've discovering just in studying this, I know going through Isaiah and Jeremiah was in Ezekiel pretty fascinating, but some of you thought we were there forever. And I did too, getting in the midst of those messages. Hosea and the rest of the minor prophets have a way. In fact, you will recognize so many things that I have quoted out of this book. You'll say, oh, that's where that's from. Oh, that's where that's from. But it is an amazing thing of how God outlines his ways with his people in a much more intimate way than in many of the other prophets. And personally, Hosea, one of the most amazing ones, because you see the heart of God in this relationship that Hosea had with his wife Gomer. Essentially, if you recap, Hosea was asked to do the unimaginable, to take a wife as a harlot. Now, we kind of pinned down that I don't believe, although the wording somehow are trying to strictly hold to it, that he actually went down to the local prostitute and married one. I think that she wasn't a prostitute. There's language in here that described that child obviously was his, that she wasn't a prostitute. But God was telling Hosea, the wife you're going to marry, she will be a prostitute. So in a sense, go marry a harlot, because that's where her heart will be. In any case, it's an amazing picture of grace, because we see how he went so far to reach her, way beyond human capacity. Even after she had left, it got to a point where it was so bad, nobody wanted her. You know, in the beginning, she was pretty attractive, I'm sure. She was the life of the party, and everybody wanted to be around her, beautiful and charming, and everybody wanted to be around Gomer. But as time went on, as she was used and went from man to man to man, I think her value, her stock kind of dropped, until eventually you find her in the slave market. She's being sold. Just worthless, sad, tragic. But most people don't realize that's exactly what sin does in our lives. You know, in the beginning, we're the hot ticket. You know, oh, everybody wants to be around us. We're the life of the party. And, you know, we got money to burn, and we've got charm to burn and beauty to burn and, you know, very hot ticket items until they run out. And just like the prodigal son, eventually no one wants to be around you when you're depressed, when you don't look that great, when you've run out of money. You don't have the qualities anymore that anybody wants. And I learned myself the way to get burned by the world very quickly is just to go live it up and think you're free to do whatever you want. And essentially, this is the sad picture of Gomer, but it contrasts the amazing love and grace of God through Hosea. Now we come in chapter 4. Because that all is summed up in the first three chapters. But now we come to chapter 4, and from 4 through 14, we actually see God kind of laying out specific issues about this relationship. Remember, Hosea representing God, and Gomer represents Israel and us by application. But as she was unfaithful, and he demonstrates that love, we have to remember that there's a lot that went into it. Now we come to chapter 4, and a lot has happened in that relationship that brought them to the point of divorce. And now God gets down to these issues. And the language that he uses is kind of like a court case. So he says, "Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel. For the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land." That was the whole story. That's why Hosea was called to his life to be a sign. And this is what the Lord is saying. He's going to bring a charge against the people of the land. There is, and this is his charge. Notice very carefully. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. No truth? Boy, that sounds very interesting considering the issues that are facing the church today on the subject of truth. What is truth? Is truth relative? The postmodern church wants you to believe that, you know, this emergent mentality that, well, we really can't be certain about whatever's right and exactly wrong. Let's just enter into a dialogue. And we talked about that last time. This is really the issue he has. Or mercy. Now, mercy is actually the word hesed in the Hebrew, which is translated by some other versions, love or loving kindness or devotion. And in a sense, you know, that idea here is that it's a picture of true devotion and true commitment in a relationship. And the Lord sees a lack of it. He also sees a lack of knowledge. That is more than just knowledge that you know about things, but truly an acknowledgement of God. There is what is lacking in our society. In fact, we've gotten away from acknowledging God. We refuse to acknowledge Him. We will try to explain anything away apart from Him. We essentially have seen a society that have marginalized, that has marginalized the knowledge of God in the public arena, in our educational institutions, in government, even in normal day-to-day interacting with people. The thought or the mention of Jesus brings an icy stare. You see this culture. This is not unlike the depths of where Israel had gotten to in its relationship with God. And the complaint that's often repeated in this book is the idea of knowledge and the refusal to acknowledge God, where the Lord says, I desire mercy and a sacrifice, you'll see in chapter 6 here, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. And it's also the point of the Ten Commandments. You know, the Ten Commandments really is about us learning how to acknowledge God with our lives. And acknowledging Him, it's because we know Him and we know His purposes are best. Why else would I want to obey the Ten Commandments? Why else would I want to do what is right except to honor Him? I truly believe Him and I have a healthy fear of Him. So the real issue that God has with Him, right down, He sets it right in the beginning, and then He gets into a little bit of a detail here. You know, it's amazing that the real desire of God is that He really wants His people to know Him and experience Him. Do you know that when Jesus was praying for us, for His disciples, and by virtue of all that would be part of the church, He was praying in John 17. And in His prayer, He says, and this is eternal life. This is eternal life, that they may know You, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom You have sent. That's true eternal life. That is a knowing, that is an acknowledging, that is an experiencing God. And the sad thing is that when you come to that place, and I think largely in Israel's position, they knew God, but though they knew Him and they had His laws, they did not glorify Him. Just like the Gentiles had an innate knowledge of God, but they did not glorify Him as God. And eventually it came down to Romans 1:28 says they didn't even like to retain God in their knowledge. And wow, that is a picture of people today. I don't want to think about it. And so God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which were not fitting. And Romans outlines those. But all these issues that God has flow from these three things. Now, verse 2, essentially, when you think about it, that because of these three things, you know, look at the moral depravity. Because they lack faithfulness, they lack that love, they lack that knowledge of God or acknowledging Him, then they are consumed by these things. Everything that we trouble ourselves with often is because of our lack in our lives. You know, young people that want to, stray, go away, do some things, you know, get away from the parents, go to college and have fun and do whatever they want, realize they have that innate desire, which we all had, because we lack a true relationship with Him. In fact, when your children go to college and they fall apart there, it's not that the college made them that way. It just kind of revealed their heart wasn't truly in a relationship, a fellowship with Him. And of course, hopefully they'll learn that their foundation was weak. They didn't know Him as much as they thought. And perhaps once the world burns them, they'll come back. But notice God's complaint. Verse 2, He says, by swearing and lying, killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed. Swearing and lying, we thinking of someone cussing over in the corner. Actually, it's one who would actually take an oath and yet be very deceptive about it, only to break it. One who kills, steals, commits adultery. There's no restraint. Now, in our nation, you know, we were certainly the recipients of tremendous blessings of God. That is undeniable. The greatness of this nation raised up to make such a difference in sending missionaries throughout the world. And that still is occurring, but there is something changed in the tone of this nation from the 60s on. Obviously, when we began to marginalize God in a society, I mean, I remember in school when it happened, when it changed. I think the first year I was in kindergarten is when the Supreme Court said, no more prayer, no more Bible in the schools. And you can look at the decline when you look at the violence that has increased, the crime rate, violent crime up 544% in this nation from the time of the 60s. Single-parent homes and those who live together apart from marriage, we're up 3 to 4 times since the 60s. Teen pregnancies up over 500% since the 60s. And the 60s were, come on, they're pretty rough. But this is how far we've gone. Therefore, he says, the land will mourn, and everyone who dwells there will waste away with the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea will be taken away. It's interesting. Is this just idiomatic for the nation spiritually, or is this an effect on the actual creation? And I have to say, and I'm no tree hugger by any stretch, but I will say this. Unrestrained greed and sin of man has certainly almost destroyed this land from the 60s and 70s. And certainly a lot of the environmental protections have helped a great deal. But then you've got other issues there. See, environmental issues today, especially with global warming, are the hot buttons. And everybody has an opinion. You got 5 people, you got 7 opinions. But the point is this, you know, even evangelicals disagree on this subject. There's the Evangelical Environmental Network that believes our stewardship of this land has got to take into consideration global warming and what we need to do about it and our cause in it. And then you've got the Cornwall Alliance, which is a whole group of other climatologists and scientists who say, no, this is, yes, global warming, certainly. I mean, we're hotter now than we were decades ago. But it's a part of a bigger picture. You can do your own research on that. I'd highly recommend the Cornwall Alliance. I think they're a lot more balanced than you get in a lot of the media today. It's almost as if we don't want to be thought of as people that don't think about the environment. At the same time, I think there needs to be reason. Now, here I see, just because of sin itself, it will affect the beasts, the birds, the fish of the sea. There's an effect that the sin of man. Now, even in that day, they could have an effect on their environment. How much more with the technology that we have in this day? But he goes on to say, and by the way, too, I want to just take stock of my own heart. As I'm going through these things to see what God has an issue with, is there something here in me, Lord, that's hindering my fellowship with you? Something about me that perhaps I'm starting to slip in areas that I'm missing something that you want to do in my life. I'm hopeful that we keep that open heart tonight. Perhaps as we are going through this passage, we could look up and say, Lord, teach me. I want to be that man. Now he says, let no man contend or rebuke another, for your people are all like those who contend with the priest. In other words, you're not going to listen. He says, therefore you'll stumble in one day. Proverbs 29:1 says, he who hardens his neck after much reproof will be suddenly broken, and that without remedy. You know, it's merciful when we get reproof, when someone kind of pulls us aside and says, what are you doing? You know, why did you do that? You're not being very nice, or you're not being very kind or right, or that wasn't appropriate. You know, if you have people in your life that can actually tell you that, you're doing well. But if you don't have people in your life that would feel comfortable about approaching you about something, I'd be nervous if I were you. Because you need friends like that around you. And this is what essentially the Lord wants us to know. He says, you're going to stumble in a day. The prophet even will stumble. And I'll destroy your mother. Now, that sounds pretty bad. You know, I'm going to even wipe out your mom. Samaria may be in mind here. You know, the mother of Israel, the capital was Samaria. And he might be speaking of that. So I don't think he's just picking other moms. But verse 6 is one of my favorite passages. I quote it all the time. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. That's what it comes down to. Because you've rejected knowledge. Not just lack of, but there's a willful rejectedness there. In other words, it's not just not knowing him, it's not acknowledging him. A refusal to acknowledge him. And this is essentially what's happened. He says, because you have rejected knowledge, I will reject you from being priest for me. Now, is he speaking to the entire nation, which he is called to be a witness in the world? And he says, basically, you're not doing the job. I'm going to find somebody else. Or is he speaking to the priests who weren't doing their job? There's a little bit of both here. He says, because you have forgotten the law of your God, I will forget your children. The more they increased, notice what the Lord's lament is, the more they sinned against me. You know, the more I blessed them, the more I gave to them, the more I throw the bounty and wealth and prosperity upon them because they were my chosen ones. Just like Hosea lavished upon his wife, and when she left for more, it wasn't enough. Even when she got to her lowest point, he was supplying behind the scenes to keep her afloat. You know, the sad thing is, she never knew it. And it's true for us. I never really knew how much God was really watching over me, even when I didn't want anything to do with him. Until after I came to him, I look back and go, wow, he had his hand on me. I could have been dead there. I could have totally messed my life up there. I could have really made a huge life changing decision. He kept me from that. And he kept me from so many things. I'm going, thank you, Lord. You know, you watched over me even when I didn't want you. And I see the Lord here in that. But sadly, the more they increase, the more they sinned, he says. I'll change their glory into shame. It's what the Lord does. He says, they eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on their iniquity. You know, Gomer had left Hosea, remember, for possessions and pleasures and pride. You know, she was interested in lots of attention. She went to the lavish feasts and the parties. She was the center. Essentially, food, sex, and attention. Isn't that really what it's about in the world? You know, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Give me what my flesh desires, just glut myself with anything I can. Give me all that my eye desires. I want this and I want that, and the sexual pleasures. And then give me the attention that I crave. You know, I want to be the center. Eat all you want, have all the sex you want, get all the attention you want. And you know, the funny thing is, we actually acknowledge as our celebrities mainly people who are indulgent, right? I mean, people that basically get all this wealth and they just start living it up for themselves, and we celebrate them instead of celebrating those who tirelessly labor to fight evil or lay their lives on the line to have our attention on them. You know, it was a sad picture in America's history when you had two notable people die. And you know who I'm talking about. One was, I mean, it was the news, all you could see. And the other was largely just a byline, Princess Diana and Mother Teresa. And this is the state of our nation, what we consider valuable, what we consider cool, and how people are going to measure you by your wealth, by your beauty, by your intelligence, by your this or that, your fame. And sadly, this is the problem. And you know what? It affects the next generation because you'll have an abundance of young people craving that celebrity status. I mean, they'll sell their soul for it. And when they get it, they realize it's not what they thought it was going to be. And he says, and it shall be like people, like priests. So I'll punish them for their ways and reward them for their deeds. You know, the leadership, particularly the priests, had become, in a sense, corrupt. And the people, essentially, you know, they kind of had the priests that they wanted. You know, the supply and demand thing. You know, when there's a demand for a slick compromiser to wink at sin and you know, just say, oh, it's not that bad. Ah, yeah, sure, you can do that. No big deal. You know, and the priest is kind of giving you the, hey, go for it sign. Essentially, I mean, that's because there's a demand for it. When people truly want to follow the Lord, they don't want to be around somebody that's a jiver. Somebody that's just talking the talk, but not really walking the walk. But the bottom line is people get the leaders they deserve. And it's true in a nation. Don't get me started about politics. And on both sides, it's corrupt through and through. For they shall eat, but not have enough. Then they shall commit harlotry, but not increase, because they ceased obeying the Lord. Multiplied evil leads to multiplied dissatisfaction. You never have enough when you stop obeying God. It's never enough. One of the prophets puts it this way, you know, when you spend what God has given to you on yourself, it's like putting money into your pockets with holes in it. It slips out. You don't know what happened. But the generous soul is made rich. You know, the paradox is when you give, you actually receive. Jesus says, when you give up your life for my name's sake, you find it. When you hold on to your life, you lose it. It's a paradox, but it's true. Here are people that are basically turned away from God and just indulging themselves with all they want to eat and all they want to do, and they don't have enough. Isn't that funny? The satisfaction quotient. went to large dissatisfaction because they have failed to follow the Lord. He says, harlotry, wine and new wine enslave the heart. Do you know that? Do you believe that? Do you believe that which you are actually indulging in, you think you have control over and you live for it, think about it? This is a sign you know when alcohol starts to get a hold of your heart and it's entrapping you. When you're thinking about it when you're not around it. When you think, when I'm going to get my next drink. Then you know you've already crossed the line. Same thing in adultery. You know you've already crossed the line when you're thinking about another person, not your spouse, when you're not around them. You've already crossed the line. There's something already hitting your heart. Because it starts there and then it eventually will wrap itself around you and it will enslave you. No one is smarter than ethyl alcohol. You toy with it. You think you've got it under control and it grips you. Now, that's not to say there aren't people that have the ability to have a glass of wine and, you know, it's no big deal for them. For my part, as a pastor, I don't need it. But there's no legalistic aspect where you can't have a drink or two. But the problem is, for many people, it is a major stumbling block. They can't say no and they can't stop and they think about it and it gets a hold of them. And they can't be content in their life without it. And eventually it controls them. And people that don't have that problem don't understand. And they think that, well, you know, they just got to get over it. And they don't realize that largely we can stumble people. So we make those choices. But it enslaves the heart. He says, my people ask counsel from their wooden idols. And their staff informs them. The staff would have been a piece of wood that they would have used in their part of their rituals and their ceremonies. He says, for the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray and they have played the harlot against their God. They've gone after other gods, but it all leads to emptiness. Again, they've got all the money, sex, and attention they could ever desire. It leaves them stuffed and they can't discover enough ways to have sex to satisfy themselves. They've got to try something else all the time. They can't be content with their spouse. And they need to get more attention today than yesterday. It's never enough. That's the treadmill that people get on in the world. And it's sad to watch them. Because you know it's so empty. Been there, done that. I thank the Lord He mercifully got a hold of my attention because I wasn't smart enough to get out of it. He says, they offer sacrifices in the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills, under oaks, poplars, terebinths, because their shade is good. Now, in that culture, of course, this was the idea of Israel. They couldn't go down to Jerusalem anymore because Jeroboam had basically said, you know, don't go there, we're separate. So he had made a place in Gilgal and Bethel in which to worship God, supposedly. But once you start deviating a little bit from God, then you even make it more convenient the next time. How many people serve God out of convenience? Well, that was exactly the motive then. Well, I want to still serve God, but it's not convenient to go down to Jerusalem. So let's do it here. And essentially, it began to be a place where they'd go on the mountaintops. They had the oaks, the poplars, the terebinth trees. The pagans essentially would carve these trees, these groves, they would call them, into phallic symbols and other types of sexually stimulating images. And then you bring the people up there and they get all excited and they begin to have the fertility rites like the pagans in the name of God. And they say, because your shade is good. You know, that it was an excuse. Oh, the shade is good up there. You know, but that wasn't the real motive. He says, therefore, he says, your daughters will commit harlotry and your brides will commit adultery. We have to see the impact of the choices. You know, we want to have freedom in this nation. We haven't been able to come up with a consensus. You know, the Supreme Court can't decide what's obscene and what's not. And freedom of speech basically rules the day when it comes to all the filth. They can't go to the libraries now without having a battle. And pedophiles, I mean, are just filtering in the libraries, getting all kinds of pornography. They can get right in many of the libraries throughout the nation. Some districts, thankfully, are holding the line against it and having filters. But many places, the ACLU will come in. No, you can't put filters on because that's a lack of freedom of speech. And so your kids, you go to the library, and what are they going to see? It's right out in the open. Someone's viewing pornography. It's out of control in many places. But you see, it's never enough. And they don't know how it will affect their next generation. When he says it right here, your daughters, your brides are going to commit harlotry and adultery. He says, I will not punish your daughters when they commit harlotry, nor your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with a ritual harlot. Therefore, people who do not understand will be trampled. What is the Lord saying here? And I think this is a principle that I think we really need to learn in our own lives. If you're afraid that God is going to really smack you hard for your sin, you've got it all wrong. He's not going to punish you for that. This is what he wants you to know about your sin. It is built in punishment. See, when it starts to get a hold of your life, see, God doesn't need to judge the lifestyle choice you make. It contains its own built-in judgment. And essentially, when you feel the freedom to do whatever, you don't know that not following God's guideline, you are going to get shipwrecked on the rocks. And that will be the painful thing. God doesn't need to judge it. He won't judge it. He's basically going to let you see the end result. It reminds me of that saying, "He who is a slave to the compass has the freedom of the seas." When you are following the Lord and obeying His way, you actually are more free than you've ever been. More free to enjoy life, to enjoy the pleasures He gives you, because when you control yourself and you channel your energies in the place that God has, the delight is magnified as opposed to the delight being dissipated by just indulging in whatever you want. He says, "Though you, Israel," verse 15, "play the harlot, let not Judah offend. And do not come up to Gilgal, nor go up to Beth-Aven, nor swear an oath, saying, 'As the Lord lives.' For Israel is stubborn like a stubborn calf. Now the Lord will let them forage like a lamb in the open country. Ephraim is joined to idols. Let them alone. Their drink is rebellion. They commit harlotry continually. Her rulers dearly love dishonor. The wind has wrapped up her in its wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices." What he's saying to Judah, he's basically saying, why would you want to go up to Gilgal and Beth-Aven? Ephraim is joined to idols. They're going to be foraging like a lamb in the open country. They're a stubborn calf. They didn't find life. You know, you're down there in Judah. You're following the Lord. You've got good kings still guiding you in the right way. You need to listen and look at the example of Samaria and the northern kingdom, because as they go down, you need to learn from it. He says their drink is rebellion. And you know, the funny thing is, there's a little play here. You might not catch it. Gilgal and Bethel were the two places where this calf was set up. But here he calls it Beth-Aven. Now Beth, or Bet, is house. Beth-El was the house of God originally, where God appeared to Jacob. It was a very important place. But they turned that thing into a ritual. You know, it's like when God does something in your life, you know, maybe one particular service. He just came upon you. The Holy Spirit moved upon your life. And you were sitting in the seat like third from the back fifth row. And you can remember every detail about that night. Well, you know, the problem would be is if you think you need to go back to that exact seat. This is where it all happened. I've got to do it here. Yes, this is where God... See, that's when it becomes, you've missed the point. You turn to almost rituals. You turn to, you know, the things, okay, if I do it this way and I follow this formula. And that's not how the Lord works. You know, that doesn't work in a marriage either. You know, when you have this special time with your wife and your husband, you're really clicking on all cylinders and you don't look around and go, okay, we were at this restaurant and we were doing this and we did... That's, we got to go back there. This is what happened. You know, Bethel was a wonderful place, but it was now called Beth-Aven. Instead of house of God, he's calling it house of vanity or idols, emptiness. Same thing. Idols is equivalent to emptiness, nothings. And the opposite of that, of course, would be the glory, the weight of God. So he's basically saying, you know, Judah's told, hey, don't go up to Gilgal or Beth-Aven. And he says, "Hear this, O priests." The result of the decline are more clearly seen in chapter 5. "Hear this, O priests. Take heed, O house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king. For yours is the judgment, because you have been a snare to Mitzpah and spread a net on Tabor." These two places that were notable, these priests had actually turned into places that were corrupting the people rather than helping them. He says, "The revolters are deeply involved in slaughter, though I rebuke them all. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hidden from me. For now, O Ephraim, you commit harlotry, and Israel is defiled. See, this is the interesting thing. Those who left God, and it's true today, if people leave God, one thing is on their mind. They're hoping God will ignore them, right? They're hoping that God will just forget about them and they can go on about their way. Why do they hope God will just go away? Well, because it's his very nature and attributes that they dislike. They have an aversion to the Father of lights who sees all things. He's holy, pure, and righteous. They hate the fact that they can't hide because he knows all things. They hate the fact that they can't kill God because he's all powerful and he does whatever he pleases. They hate that he doesn't change and that he's everywhere. They can't run from him. Like Jonah, we see Jonah trying to run from God, right? And God, we forget, God knows everything. And Jonah was told, those who regard worthless idols forsake their own mercy. Now, Jonah, you go down that road and you're only hurting yourself. And that's the whole point, is Gomer ran for Hosea. Who did she hurt in the end? Yeah, Hosea was hurt because he loved her. But it's a different hurt that when love for someone, and you see that someone deeply hurting themselves, that's a different kind of a hurt than it is that you're actually hurting yourself. You know, when she left, she tried to put Hosea behind her. She thought she could forget about him, but he didn't forget her. This isn't the same as a spouse that's hurt by their mate leaving and they beg to have them back because they can't live without them. I need you. And they're in pain. And sometimes, you know, you see these guys treat their wives miserable. And, you know, next thing you know, their wives are packing their stuff up. And now all of a sudden the guy wants religion. You know, he wants to get his heart to, okay, God, you know, whatever. I want my wife back. I'm in pain. You know, Hosea didn't feel that kind of pain. I want you to know. Hosea wasn't hurting for himself because God had done such a work in his heart. All he could think about was what was best for her. And I think that's the kind of love that really spells the real thing. This is the kind of love that God has for us. He's searching for us, not because he's wounded that we won't follow him. And he's got an ego that he needs everybody. See, that's what I used to think, honestly. I used to think that God is so powerful, he's got to push his weight around. He's got to get everybody to follow him. And, you know, I don't want to follow him. I'm going to rebel. I thought I was tough. What I didn't understand was that God's jealous for me, not jealous in the same sense I would be. He wants the best for me. His love is wounded in that he wants the best for me. And when I go my own way, it pains me, and that hurts him that I'm in pain. That's a whole different kind of thing. See, we have this paradox. We want to be known, but we don't want to be known too much. You know what I mean? It's like we want people to know who we are, but we don't want them to know all about us. So we tend to hide. That's a great picture of the celebrity dilemma, by the way. You know, about the time they get everybody to want to be them. Everybody, the paparazzi are out there taking pictures. They never let them alone. And they just want to be left alone. They don't want to be known in everything. They don't want to be captured by a photographer in an embarrassing pose or whatever. It's very intruded into their life. So they've wanted the fame and the fortune, the money that goes with it. And now they've got the paparazzi chasing them wherever they go. You know, we have a need to be known. We do. God made us in his image. We long for his perfect love, but sin has distorted this need. Now we want others to think of us as great and others to seek us out. But then when they do, we keep them at a distance. You know, and that's why the more selfish, the more that love grows cold in a society, the more you see violence, the more you see a lack of commitment. Marriage, for example, you see a lot more people are shacking up. They don't want to make the commitment to marriage. Even Christians, foolishly, unwisely, disobediently, are shacking up. And of course, they're going to realize real quickly that it's, hopefully that when they realize it's wrong, they rectify it. They make it right. They get out, they stop living together, and they want to honor God. And if God has called them to be married, then, you know, then they can move toward marriage because that's a commitment. When you're just living with each other, you can still keep your own separate individual life and you can keep that identity to the degree where you don't like certain things to be known. But when you're married, you know, there's no secrets. But even in a marriage, frankly, I mean, you can be married for 20 years and maybe there's some things you never told your spouse. That degree of yieldedness is a challenge, but with our relationship with God, it's very much so. God knows everything about us. Everything. He still loves us, which is an amazing thing to begin with. You remember from that first date, you know, those of you who are married, that first date, there's not a lot of disclosure on that first date. You're putting your best foot forward, you're looking pretty smooth and pretty debonair, pretty cool. You know, but then what happens is the degrees of disclosure come in, you become more and more comfortable to open up, but still we don't know. There's only so much we can know about ourselves. In fact, this is what happens in marriage when you get to know your spouse better than they know themselves. That's the real test of a marriage. Because you could say to your spouse, you know, you do this all the time. I do not do that. Yes, you do. No, I do not. You don't know what you're talking about. Honey, yes, you do. I know. Oh, you know, and it's funny because they can't see themselves. This is normal. I remember the other day, my wife said I did something. I said, you're crazy. I don't do that. I said to my daughter, Jessica, honey, you know, I don't do that. Yeah, you do, Dad. Ganging up on me. This isn't fair. But it's true. We just don't see ourselves. Interestingly enough, my wife handed to me today, and actually I put it on my blog this week, but there's a college study on self-esteem. But it said this, it says, those who regarded themselves as kind and cheerful and warm were actually regarded by most as the most hostile, cold, and unkind. And the conclusion was, only the jerks had high self-esteem. I think that's hilarious. You know, the big thrust we've got to have, that's the problem in the world, it's a low self-esteem. Well, the people that have it shouldn't have it. That's the problem. To everyone else, you know, we can posture and present a false impression, but not with God. We can manage and control other relationships, but not with God. He's uncontrollable. God knows. And essentially, this is what he's expressing here. You know, I know Ephraim and Israel is not hidden from me, he says. And this is what was going on. He says in verse 4, he says, they don't direct their deeds toward turning to their God, for the spirit of harlotry, there you have it again, is in their midst, and they do not know the Lord. Isn't that what he keeps back with? It's about acknowledging God. When you don't, and you know, you might at church, but then when you go out from church, do you acknowledge him? Do you acknowledge him sitting there in the car next to you when you're going to places where you shouldn't be going? Do you acknowledge him when you're doing things you shouldn't be doing? Is he there? Is he present? He is there. You just don't acknowledge it. That is the problem. That's what happened to Israel. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. See, even the southern kingdom was starting to get caught up in some of their sin. Because Israel, the northern kingdom, frankly, they look like things were really cooking for them for a while. They were prosperous, powerful, and Judah was a little bit envious of them. Just like you could be envious sometimes of people that have a lot of wealth and power and money and do all that they want to do. And maybe you're going through a very lonely time. You're honoring the Lord and the Lord isn't answering your prayer and you feel like he's not. But, you know, this is normal because God's ways in working with us, he's looking to the outcome. So you're a parent and your children have friends and their parents give them all the candy they want, and your kid comes over and says, how come I don't get candy in this house? They get it all the time. Well, obviously there's a problem with a parent who would give their kids all the candy they want. But that's kind of where Israel was. You know, just let's indulge ourselves. And so Judah was looking over there, like looking across the fence. Look what he's getting, that's not fair. But God loved Judah and was helping them work through those things. Ephraim was joined to idols. He let him alone. That's the scariest part of this passage, you know, that you see, is that Ephraim joined to idols, let him alone. I'm not going to deal with him anymore. When the Lord basically says, let's let him go. Give you over to a debased mind, that's not a good thing. So Judah was actually stumbling, but they refused to have their deeds turned toward their God. They didn't know. It says, with their flocks and their herds, they go to seek the Lord. That is, they're going to bring on their little sacrifices up to their high places, but they won't find him, for he has withdrawn himself from them. See, even if they do vainly attempt to seek Him, the Lord is not going to be sought by them. He's not going to be heard by them. They have dealt treacherously with the Lord, for they have begotten pagan children. Now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. You know, they're raising children. Isn't it a wonder that our children are like us? You know, is it a wonder that they might follow the ways we're compromising and we're watching stuff on TV when they go to bed, and they can hear and they know, you know, that they watch that stuff that you shouldn't be watching, and they think, wow, when I get an adult, I'm going to do whatever I want. That's a model you set. You model it for your kids. And so we shouldn't be surprised. They've begotten pagan children now. They actually literally connected themselves to some of the pagan rituals. And now what they used to worship, the new moon, is going to devour them and their heritage. They thought they were seeking God, but their deeds don't permit a real return. That's the point. Their hearts can't really let go of something that's just wrapped itself around them. Years ago, when we lived in another house, we had a neighbor couple that were living together. And, you know, we struck up a great friendship with them, really reaching out to them and had an impact on them. And they saw our life. I mean, they saw us all the time, you know, playing with our kids and living our lives and being a good witness. And this man was a son of a preacher, and he was backslidden. And I remember how he, in a very, very honest moment, he said, "I wish I had what you have." And I said, "Well, listen, I'd love to pray with you, you know, and I that can happen. I mean, God's no respecter of persons. I'm not some special person. He would love to start working in your life again if you let him." And he says, "No, it can never happen." And I said, "Why? Why don't you return to the Lord?" And I'll never forget, he went to the kitchen. I was in his house. He went to the kitchen. He grabs a can of beer and he puts it on the table in front of me. He goes, "Because of this right there is why I can't return to the Lord." That had so gripped him, alcohol, he could not escape it in his mind. And it was sad. It was tragic. They eventually moved to another state and we kind of lost track of them, but we still pray for them all the time. You know, at least he was honest, though. You know, a lot of people fool themselves into thinking they can manage walking with idols and walking with God. At least he knew that he needed to deal with that before he'd really return to the Lord. The problem is, if you seek with this half-heartedness, he won't be found of you. And sometimes people, you know, when you start getting really plugged into a church too, you start really getting relationships and you're wonderful, you're making friends now. But again, we tend to want to manage those friendships in a way to keep people at a distance. Don't let them too close. And then something happens where they see a little bit of imperfection in you. They get a little too close and they see something that you're doing that you know you don't want them to see. And now that's the real test. Do you just like, I can't hang around here anymore. You know, you people are too judgmental here. I'm going to go to another church. And you run, basically. And people do that. They've run from church to church to church to church. In Southern California, we saw it continually. The minister, the people get to know too much about them. Their ego's hurt. They leave for another, and can always find another place where you can start over and manage the relationship so that only people know only so much about you. But you are the one that gets hurt in the end, because you are the one that's missing it. Blow the ram's horn in Gibeah, he says, the trumpet in Ramah. Verse 8, cry aloud at Beth Aven, look behind you, O Benjamin. That is to the south, you know, don't be looking up here. He says, Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel, I'll make known what is sure. The princes of Judah are like those who remove a landmark. I'll pour out my wrath on them like water. One of the subtleties is that they wanted to appear pure while still lying and deceiving. That's what removing the landmark was all about. The law was clear. Cursed is the one who removes the landmark. What were the landmarks? Well, they were the border lines between your property and someone else's. Your tribe had a certain boundary. Your family within the tribe had a boundary within that. Immediate family had a boundary within that. So, you know, you sneak out at night and you slip the boundary over a little. Give yourself 15 more feet. And then you go out the next day and you talk real friendly to your neighbor. Hey, neighbor. Hey, you want me to help you do something over there? Yeah, let me come. And you pretend like you're this great friend when you just rip them off. The same thing the Lord hated in Proverbs 11, dishonest scales with differing weights. In other words, you've got a scale that you're buying and a scale that you're selling. They're supposed to be the same, but they always give you a little bit extra. So you go to the baker and you say to the baker, hey, I want a pound of this particular bread or a loaf of this bread, you know, that weighs so much. And so he puts this thing on the scale and it's a little more than a pound. He goes, ah, go ahead, I'll let you have it for a pound. You think, wow, what a nice man. But what you don't know is his scale's tweaked a little bit. He actually just sold you 3/4 of a pound and made it seem like he was this noble, generous person. God hates that. And essentially that was what was happening. When they removed the landmarks, it was a devious way. You appeared cool and nice and wonderful, but you were really living a lie. And there are people that do that. They're only hurting themselves in the end. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked by human precept. And then he gives two illustrations, the moth and the lion. And it's an illustration for how God, the subtlety comes in first, and then eventually we are ravished. First, the moth. He says, I will be to Ephraim like a moth, and to the house of Judah like rottenness. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to King Jareb, yet he cannot cure you nor heal of your wound. The idea is that he got a little problem, and he thought he could solve it, and he thought that he could get some Band-Aid on the problem. And he goes to this king and the wound, the whole thing, but it wasn't going to work. And the Lord says, I'm going to be to him like a moth, rottenness. It represents a slow decay of your spiritual walk. Then he says, I'll be like a lion to Ephraim and a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear at them and go away, and I'll take them away, and no one shall rescue. See, God will first be like a moth in your life. In other words, he lets you go and you start decaying. And if you don't get sick of yourself and return to him, then he'll be like, mercifully, be like a lion. Then he'll get your attention. Similar truth in Proverbs 24, where he says, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty comes like a prowler and your need like an armed man. First it comes in like a prowler. It sneaks in. You start lacking in your life. You start indulging yourself, and little bit by little bit, you're dissatisfied more and more. And eventually you don't have enough you need. And then your need comes in like an armed man and it takes you by force. All of a sudden, you're in desperate need. This is how it works. He says, I will return to my place till they acknowledge their offense. Then they will seek my face. In their affliction, they will earnestly seek me. Ultimately, look at the Lord's heart. This is what kind of Hosea was. When he was helping her and helping her and helping her behind the scenes, and then that wasn't working, so he withdrew the help. Then her need just hit her hard. And then she began to be open after she was being sold as a slave. But you know, do you want just a Band-Aid on your spiritual walk? I had a brother come to me about an issue that he's facing in his life, and I knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted me just a quick fix, a quick Band-Aid on the situation. Don't deal with the real root of the issue, because I don't want to go there. Just, can you help me out with this? And that's what a lot of people are looking at for the Lord. Some marriages are in terrible shape. Communication's next to nothing. Intimacy's gone. Our heart's hardened. They're just existing. And they just put a Band-Aid on each of the problems instead of really get down to the root of the Lord dealing with them. And that happens in relationships with God as well. The three verses of chapter 6 actually conclude this whole section. So I'm just going to read them because they just conclude. He said, come, let's return to the Lord. For he has torn, but he will heal us. He's stricken, but he will bind us up. And after 2 days, he will revive us. And on the third day, he will raise us up that we may live in his sight. Now, there's almost a picture there of Israel. After 2,000 years of being scattered through the world, the third day he's going to raise them up. I believe that time is very close. But it's also a picture, too, for the Messiah in identifying with his people. After 2 days, and then the third day being raised up, he says, let us know, let us pursue the knowledge of the Lord. His going forth is established as the morning. He will come to us like the rain, like the latter and the former rain. So again, let's pursue to acknowledge the Lord in our lives, the knowledge of the Lord. Let's appeal to the Lord to return to him, because there's hope. The rain will come. Famine once, but rain soon.